All right. Brings us to item six, review of total portfolio performance for the period ending June 30, 2024, Q2. Danny, good morning.
Good morning.
Any preliminary thoughts, Tim, before we turn it over to
Preview. When we were reviewing the second quarter report, we saw a cash flow discrepancy, worked with Verus. Turns out it was a issue with the beginning market value of private equity. Unfortunately, that did result in a performance error in the first quarter that's been corrected. After this board meeting, we will post the corrected first quarter performance report to our website. But we have gone through this with Verus, and Verus has some comments on what happened and what's been corrected there. But you need to be aware that there is a restatement of the first quarter performance because the private equity balance was inflated at the end of the quarter.
Created a difference in the net asset value, if I'm remembering.
Yeah, essentially, the cash flows were correct. The net asset value for private equity was about $100 million too high, so significant on a $1.3 billion program. And that's been corrected. The second quarter numbers have been rerun.
All right, thank you. Well, good morning. I guess we can start off with that one if you'd like. It's we're on 6A, so the floor is yours.
Sure. Good morning. Yeah, so my name's Danny Sullivan. I'm filling in this month for my colleague Scott Whalen. So he's got two more weeks left on his sabbatical, and he'll be back next month. I'll be covering the second quarter performance and investment landscape, but I do want to address the memo that was written. So as Tim alluded to, there was a correction in the first quarter performance report, specifically the private equity return. So there's a manual process that we have once we receive our Stepstone file. That's the private market consultant. We consolidate several funds into one line item in the report, and there was an error when that was done. The cumulative distribution amount was input as the NAV, or the market value. And so we discovered that in the second quarter. We don't think that there was any financial impact of this, and that the actuary didn't use it in any of their calculations or any of their reporting. But it is still serious to us, and serious that we're implementing some additional audits on our internal process to ensure that the data file that we receive from our private market consultant and then the data file that we modify, that we manually edit, matches at the end of the day. And so that we think that that'll resolve this, and it should not happen. So I'll stop there and see if there's any questions.
Sure. Thank you. Any questions or comments for Danny?
Process?
Yeah, so the file that we receive has several line items for this one fund, and so we go through and basically sum up that information for the purposes of the report. So it is
all right. Any other questions or comments for Danny on the item?
Just quick one. I do appreciate you explaining the issue in Scott's conveniently timed absence. So it's a great time to bring out the questions. I think I should start with a little bit of an apology myself, really, because when you're presenting the returns to the board, it's a level of review on our part also that nobody caught. So just a question about the back and forth. When you all produce the performance reports, it goes to staff for some kind of review, right? And I'm wondering what are the kind of catch-all steps there to find an error like this.
Yeah, so typically when we take a look at this at the staff level, we're looking at the aggregate quarterly cash flows and seeing if those match what our internal records look like. The change in investment market value is largely, it's a Verus produced number, so we're focused on, we have the cash flow numbers, do they match, does it match our cash flow numbers within the tolerance? And then we take a look at the top level performance, total fund, each one of the sub portfolios, are we seeing something surprising or not? In this particular instance, it was the private equity line item that was marked up that was not out of line with the public market, so it wasn't flagged because it was a mark up and public markets had already moved up for a couple of quarters. It was in the direction. I want to make sure that staff is not becoming quality control for Varis, and we're doing top level reasonableness checks there, and it really is the cash flows that we focus on in our analysis.
Any other comments or questions on this? Yeah, thank you, Danny, for being the person who happened to be the substitute player showing up and having to carry the water on that. So it's appreciated to understand the circumstance, and thank you for your candor. All right, so let's carry on.
I don't have a clicker to move through the presentation. Or I can just tell the page numbers.
We can use an overhead projector.
Remember those?
Dating myself with that one.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, so starting with the quarterly investment landscape, I wanted to hit just on a few high-level themes that we observed over the second quarter. The first is that inflation is nearing that 2% target that the Fed is looking to get to. The second is that the economy still remains really strong, and the labor market itself is not unsustainably strong or weak. And we'll talk a little bit about that. And then the third topic I want to talk about is this path of interest rates for the Fed, right? So the market is expecting that we're going to start seeing rate cuts next month. And if you look at the Fed funds implied rate path, it's expected to go from 5.25, which is where it's at today, down to their 3% target by the end of 2025. And so I just want to hit on a couple of things of why we think it might take a little bit longer than the market's expecting. Move on to, oh yeah, thank you. Title inflation, there we go. So if we look at inflation through the second quarter, and if you look down at the bottom left chart, the US Consumer Price Index or CPI year over year, this gives you a very long-term perspective on what inflation has looked like. But if you look at the far right of that bottom left chart, you can see this pretty sharp turn. So inflation has definitely turned the corner. If you look at the middle bottom chart, there's many potential paths for where inflation may go from here. And we can't be certain which path it's going to go on. The fact that we've seen inflation fall to 3% is quite encouraging, but there is one area that is quite sticky in the CPI print, and that's shelter costs. And shelter costs have really prevented inflation from breaking below that 3% barrier and getting down to that 2% level that the Fed is looking to get to. And so this is one of the reasons why we think it might take a little bit longer. We did see shelter costs increases slow in the June report, but this has really been the area of the CPI print that has just caused inflation to not be able to get down to that target as quickly as the Fed would like. The Fed has a dual mandate, right? So the first is price stability, which is the inflation component, and the second component is maximum employment. And so the two things that the Fed is balancing is getting inflation down while keeping the labor market strong. And so when we look at the labor market, if you look at the bottom left chart there of U.S. unemployment, and we show in this chart we're showing two different unemployment metrics. The U3 is the most common one. If you hear unemployment in the headlines, they're usually talking about U3, which is just unemployed people looking for work. U6 is a broader measure, so it includes discouraged workers and underemployed people, and that's a little bit higher. The point here, though, is that if you look at the labor market over the long term, it's really strong. if you look over this 20-year period in that bottom left chart, we're near the lows that we've seen in that 20-year period. And if you extend that even further, that still holds true. So the labor market is really strong. The Fed raised interest rates and held them up and has held them up and has not really materially impacted the labor market. So their dual mandate of price stability and maximum employment, this is the trade-off that they're making. If you look, though, at the bottom right chart and you look at kind of maybe the slight tick that we've started seeing in unemployment changing over the 12 to 18-month period, that's a potential sign of cracks, right? That we have seen unemployment start to slightly tick back up. And so for these reasons, the fact that we continue to see inflation kind of stubbornly at that 3% level, and the fact that we see unemployment and the labor market remaining quite strong, we think it's probably going to take a little bit longer to get down to the Fed's target than the end of next year. So that's what I wanted to hit on just for the market segment of our discussion today. Are there any questions that I can answer before I dive into the third quarter performance report? Or the second quarter performance report, sorry.
Any questions of Danny? I'm not seeing any hands.
Okay, so I will dive into, I've got to move a bunch of slides forward here. Should be start here, portfolio reconciliation. So we had beginning market value of $11.27 billion, net cash outflow of $124 million, an appreciation in the investment portfolio of $154 million, and an ending market value of $11.3 billion. So that's kind of the high-level market value cash flows that we saw over the quarter. Just a quick reminder, all of the second quarter performance report is looking at our old asset allocation. The asset allocation change is going to be implemented going forward, so we'll see that starting to flow through into the performance report. But we talk about policy index and implementation benchmark numbers. Just to be clear, we're talking about the prior figures. Diving into the high-level performance, net of fees, here on PDF page 66. Total fund over the most recent quarter was up 1.4% versus the policy index up 1.7, the implementation benchmark up 1.6. So lagging behind the two benchmarks there. The story is different, though, if you look year-to-date. The portfolio is up 4.7, outperforming the policy index by 40 basis points and outperforming the implementation benchmark by 80 basis points. And strong returns over that one-year rolling period also. Total fund up 8.6% and outperforming the policy index at 8.4 and the implementation benchmark at 8. One thing I want to address, and I'll dive into this in just a second, is the diversifying asset class. If you look over that one-year period, that's one of the laggards that we're seeing recently. So the diversifying asset class was up 1.1% versus the custom diversifying benchmark at 5.4%. So I just want to put a pin in that because I'm going to address why that is in just a couple of minutes. We'll move on to 73, this should be the net of fee performance. There we go. So diving into the more granular breakdown of performance across the portfolio, there's a few areas here where we saw some strength and a few areas where we saw some weakness. Looking within the domestic equity book, Boston Partners, if you look over the year-to-date period, was up 10.4%. versus its benchmark at 6.6, and over the one-year period up 21.1 versus 13.1. So some really strong performance. That's your large cap value manager. It's a concentrated strategy. They hold about 90 stocks, and they've done a really good job over the one-year and year-to-date period. Same with Emerald Advisors. This is your small cap growth manager. They've done a really good job with stock selection over the year-to-date and one-year period. 1 year up 14.4 versus the benchmark of 9.1. If you move down into the international equity section, this hasn't been as strong. Pyford is one of the international equity managers. Over the 1 year period, up 6.4 versus the benchmark of 13.5. So some pretty significant underperformance there. This is really attributed to some poor stock selection in the UK, Australia, and Japan. And specifically, they have an underweight to Japan. So they're betting that Japan is an area that they don't want to be in this portfolio, which really did not work for them very well through second quarter. But if you look at third quarter, the Japanese equity market has been having some issues, and we think that it's certainly outperforming its benchmark during the third quarter, but those numbers won't be reflected until the next quarterly report. But that's the bet that they were making, was really this pretty large underweight Japan.
What do we think about that bet that Pyrford made? I mean, in terms of, did you have a concern about that? Do you think that it's something that their decision making needs to be watched more closely?
No, I don't think it needs to be watched more closely. I think we hire these managers to beat their benchmarks, and we have to let their bets run their course. So this might be 12 to 18 months from the time that they incepted that position. And so I think that's a little too short of a time frame to make a call of if it was successful or not. We've started to see it turn here in the third quarter. And so it's to be seen if that's going to be successful or not. But that's the bet that they made. And I think we hire these managers to outperform these benchmarks and to make these bets. And that's what they're doing.
So in this particular instance, Pyrford made that bet 18 months ago?
I don't know the exact time frame. I was looking at the one-year attribution, so it was at least within the last 12 months.
Okay. Thank you.
Looking within emerging market equities, we have a couple of managers that are just hitting the ball out of the park here. So PIMCO RAE up 10.3% versus its benchmark of 6.5, up 22.4% over the one-year period versus its benchmark of 14.1. So this is a deep value strategy, and they think that they're positioned really well. That deep value strategy is positioned really well to benefit from structurally higher interest rates and inflation in the emerging market space, because they believe that value tends to outperform in these periods. So they've had really strong recent performance, and they feel really good about the prospects going forward too. So encouraging and nice to see that performance there. The other emerging market manager, TT Emerging Markets, has really strong performance year to date, up 13.2 versus 7.5 for the benchmark. That's encouraging for us. They had some turnover on their team recently, and so we placed a provisional flag on this firm, just watching to see if that turnover was going to have any sort of performance issues. And we still have full conviction that they're able to find good opportunities and manage risk effectively. And this is encouraging to see that the performance is, in fact, supporting that opinion.
What's the process on, you mentioned their prior performance had raised a flag or they had some issues. Is there a process by which that information gets vetted and then discussed and presented?
Yeah, it means there's more points of touching base with that firm. It's more frequent touch base. So we have our standard touch base with each firm periodically. But if there's a provisional flag, there's going to be more touch points throughout the year. There's going to be more questions that we're asking. And we're just on a little more high alert than we would be with a firm that didn't have a provisional flag.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
And just for the executive summary graphs.
Slide 54, yes.
Yeah, and can you comment on that? I mean, we're... It looks like the new benchmark is much more realistic, but still, the 3-year versus 5-year, so forth. I mean, our position overall. Do you have any comments on where we're at there and where do you think we might be going?
Yeah, so when you look at these charts, the area you don't want to be is the bottom right, and the area you want to strive to be in is the top left, right? And so if I'm looking over a 3-year period and a 5-year period, you guys are on the left side of the chart, so that's positive. But obviously we want to be moving up to the left, right? What I'd say is, you know, this is a universe of other defined benefit plans. So they're facing similar challenges as you are, right, in meeting their meeting benefit payments and ensuring everybody has secure retirement. But this portfolio is constructed for your specific plan. So comparison is fair in that, you know, these other plans are going through similar constraints as you. But I think that this portfolio has been constructed for your needs. What I would say, though, is, you know, we do want to see that moving up to the left. Not every 3, 5, 10-year period is the same. And so we think we've built a portfolio. We think you've built a portfolio that's going to weather different types of periods better than peers. And just to put a proof statement behind that, if you just look where your red or your blue dot is and you look just directly to the right of that, those are all peers that are getting the same return as you're getting for a lot more risk, or for more risk, right? And so, you know, ideally we want to be upper left, but I don't think there's anything to do at this point. There is a new asset allocation coming in that we hope will help move to the upper left. But, you know, each period's different, and we're constructing a portfolio that's intended to do well across many different types of environments. So I'd say more recently, the 3- and 5-year period, if you held an awful lot of large cap U.S. equities, you did really well and you're in the upper left, or if you, right? So there's certain asset allocations that are preferred in different periods than others. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, so this is out there, so people look at it and then there's that comparison to other systems and so forth. So I think it's always good to touch or give a comment on this and the relevance of it.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important to state that are we achieving what we need to achieve for our particular plan? And if that's so, then great. But then otherwise, why are we comparing ourselves to everybody else? But there it is, right? So there's a comparison term. So I think that needs context. And because everyone else who's looking at this is saying that, and like, you know, how come we're there versus someone else? And then the other question would be, I mean, well, just, I'm so glad we tweaked our benchmark. Because that's much more useful. And is there any type of graph that looks over time where our red square has been moving? And then considering the changes in the economy and all that stuff and the investment returns, taking that into context. But are we moving in kind of a right direction, or we're still trying to sort that out?
Yeah, I think we can't predict what's going to happen in the next 3 to 5 years. And I think the way that, and I hope this is answering your question, I think the way the portfolio is constructed, we will be in the top left corner in some periods, and we will be in the bottom left. But I think the way that this portfolio is constructed, kind of averse to some of these drawdowns, having a diversifying and liquidity bucket to help in those periods, the fact that you're not a 60-40 portfolio, the fact that you're not a 70-30, there are going to be periods when you're going to underperform. But the way that the portfolio is constructed, it's built to meet your needs, and we think that it is doing that.
Okay. Well, I was asking about going back over the years, where is that dot
Could
new?
We look at that?
I don't know if that's easily available or not, but so that would be one question. And then the other point of context is there a potential impact with respect to our illiquid assets that can have impact on where we sit? So we don't necessarily realize returns from private equity for years out. And is that perhaps one of the reasons why we're
Yeah, so to your question about if we can look at this through time, I'd have to get back to you on that. I haven't seen that chart, but it's possible that we could create that. Yeah, your peers who have less private assets are going to realize their returns more real time than you will, right? So if you have private assets in your program, those returns are going to be realized slower over time. So I think that that's a good point that you're making, and I'd agree with it, that the more illiquid assets you have in your portfolio, maybe the more lagged you are from getting to where you truly, to the dot placement that you truly do.
Danny, if I could, and Tim as well, I wouldn't really ask you to go find that. And the reason I say that is we're looking at our return into the past. And looking at risk in the past, all of us can get that correct. So I don't see a ton of value of doing that. I'd rather that focus be avoiding risk in the future that we don't know. And I think that's a great deal of time of what you guys do already. But trying to recreate that and put it in, it's going to be an additional slide we look at. And then, David, to your point was, people are going to look at that and say, well, why aren't you in the upper left if that's the most ideal? And it's because our risk tolerance for our needs is vastly different than these. Well, is different than these others. Vastly, we don't know. But spending that time, I think value add is looking at the risk that we can take and tolerate going forward as opposed to what our decision did. But that's the first one. The second question I think is critical to understand. When some of those other more illiquid assets pay off and realize can greatly change things, as we saw at the start of this whole piece about even just the adjustment in the net asset value. So while I appreciate this slide, it can confuse us, it can confuse the public, and adding more to it, I don't think is as valuable as what risk is do we foresee in the future. I get that it can be a predictor, but I mean,
oh, no, I just seeing kind of what our trend has been over time. Are we trending in the right direction or so forth with respect to, our position on that graph? So it's not necessarily using it as a future predictor. It's just or predictor of future performance or placement. But what's our trend been? That was the only question.
I think if I look back, we certainly have trended to the left side of the chart. So prior to 2015, we had an asset allocation that was more similar to our peers, even though we had better funded status and we were going cash flow negative. And there was a reason we made adjustments at the time and, very purposefully shifted to the left side of that chart. I think, when you're on the right side of that chart and you have a bad period, well, you've taken on more risk and you've had a bigger loss. That's a difficult position to get out of. It is. Those are challenging periods. When you're on the left-hand side of the chart, your volatility is reduced, and therefore anything you want to adjust, you're coming from you're not down as much when you want to make the adjustment and get you right back there. So I think there's been a very intentional shift to the left-hand side. And as Danny said, we would all like that number, that the dot to move up to the upper left-hand side. I think, the most recent asset allocation, we took a look at what's not working in the portfolio, and there were asset classes that were eliminated. We also have to be cognizant that this has been a market that's been led by seven stocks in the United States.
NVIDIA's up 166% year to date. It's up 1,000% since this run began. Incredible. The global stock market index is now 65% United States. All the stocks in the world, 65% of them are U.S. So you had this incredible concentration, and I think the fact that we've had diversification, and the board took a look in the asset allocation and kind of confirmed the diversification you wanted there. It hasn't paid off in this particular period. We've had private equity returns have gone flat for 3 years because there hasn't been exit activity. I think that's largely going to change over the upcoming year with rates coming back down. Real estate, we've all documented very well the challenges in that space, and that's we're hoping we're near the end of that markdown cycle. The office space has been challenging. The multifamily space has had its challenges. And then we're taking a look at private credit. That private credit is the one area of private markets where we do get more current marks because there's an income stream associated with them. And that's held up quite well. So I think, we moved to the left. I think some of the changes we've made over the last 3 years have been largely in those private markets. Those are going to take time to come to fruition. The public market mandates that just didn't work out are exiting the portfolio. So we're going to have to, we made those changes. Unfortunately, this is something where you're going to have to get a couple of quarters in to see, what the direction is of these changes, but that's something we're going to be keeping an eye on.
Jerry, I'm sorry.
At the risk of mixing apples and oranges, and I'll probably regret bringing this up, there, you point out that Pureford and TT are kind of hitting it out of the ballpark recently and doing well, exceeding their benchmarks. And yet later on, there's another report. This is actually Tim's report, 6B, where Pureford and TT are listed as underperforming. And I don't know if that's a different measure or a different time period. Which are we to focus on?
So I think in terms of measuring whether the manager is implementing their portfolio as expected, the Verus report. The CIO report really looks at is the asset class and the manager, are they performing according to long-term expectations? And there we see some underperformance. And TT certainly has had strong recent performance. They had a difficult 2022 and 2023. We took a look at the portfolio. We could understand some of the drivers. In 2023, the lead portfolio manager stepped away for a sabbatical. It was fully communicated to us at the time that he was likely coming back. We ultimately decided not to, and we had to kind of re-underwrite the team as it stands on a go-forward basis. We've done on-sites, we've gotten comfortable, and that recent performance has been in the upswing there. But when I take a look at my CIO report, I'm taking a look at that 3 to 5 year number, and they still have those deficits there. So the recent trend, really, really solid, but they need to pull out of that 3 year underperformance.
Okay. So this is not just, I guess we believe this is not just a one-off. There's a correcting trend here, or hopefully it's a correcting trend.
TT's strategy involves both a top-down macro view and a bottom-up stock selection. The bottom-up stock selection hasn't really changed. There's been analyst turnover, but there's always analyst turnover there. The process has remained the same. The person making the top-down macro call did change. Mm-hmm. And we think that's, I think there was a strong bias towards certain markets that had outperformed kind of from early COVID up until 2022, and that they didn't rotate out as quickly as they should have. The new person making the macro calls says, you're coming in with fresh eyes. You're not coming in with, the bias of past decisions. They've been more active in that. Thus far, over the past 9 months, it looked like it's added value.
So is it possible that Mr. Whalen and the head of TT are at the same sabbatical? comparing notes on things? I guess not. The answer is...
It's a tough room. Yes.
Okay. I just didn't know which...
Different periods, different measures. And I'm going to address that in the CIO report. Okay. There's some changes you want to take a look at there.
Very good. Thank you.
And I just wanted to make sure I didn't misstate anything on Pyford. Maybe I said the wrong name, but for Pyford, I was saying that they had taken an underweight Japan bet.
Right.
And they had underperformed. So I don't, if I misstated that, I apologize, but that was the manager.
Yeah, those were not inconsistent, I think, from the standpoint of Tim's report versus the quarterly.
The Pureford position, we recognize that there's a few challenges there. I think they're still in the realm of, in the range of expectations. TT, given the performance, the underperformance and the personnel changes, that's where you say, whoa, we have to go back and re-underwrite this. Or, is the ship being righted, and who's righting the ship? That's a different situation. Pureford's been very consistent in their personnel. I think it was PIMCO was the other one that Danny had highlighted as being out of the park, and that's quantitative deep value in emerging markets, and it's had a really strong run. It's interesting that you look at value equities, and we can talk ad nauseum about the death of value. It's a U.S. phenomenon. In the rest of the world, value has worked. In the U.S., it hasn't, because you've had this narrow leadership in the marketplace. So these seven stocks that just run and run and run, coupled with, we could argue about, is the Fed's intervention cutting off kind of price discovery in some of these value stocks? It's a little bit more philosophical, but I think the fact that you've had just such narrow leadership in the U.S. market has swamped all the other effects. In the rest of the world, you haven't had that bright light on just a few companies. It's been more spread out. And there you see the value work. PIMCO is an example of that in the emerging market space.
Any other questions or comments?
One of the best 10 years for the market. And looking at that slide right now here, I understand that these are different plans with different goals, I guess. But there is only 5 dots lower than us on the rate of return and more than 10 closer to the left. And one of those 10 that have less risk than us, about 5 of them pretty high up. And I understand that we kind of designed that portfolio to be to have less risk, but even that slide that you showed before, that one that shows performance and underperformance based on a benchmark, even in a down year, it was like 2022, I think, or 2021, we still underperformed. So it was -8% on the benchmark, and we did -10, almost -11. So to me, maybe I don't understand, but it doesn't look like we are that good on a down year as well. So
I think if you're looking at the prior page, it's comparing the total fund to the policy index, right?
There is a policy and a benchmark. Yeah. And I remember it was -8 on both of them, and we had -10.8, I think. So it's almost 3%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that slide doesn't compare against the peers, but it does compare against your policy index. And I think one of the reasons why we added the implementation benchmark as another benchmark was really an acknowledgement that there was mismatch between the way that the policy index is constructed and the way that the total fund is implemented. So if you're looking at this chart and you see that the policy index is above where we're at on these charts, then yeah, it's getting a higher return for that same level of risk. But we acknowledge that we can't implement that the same way that we've constructed the policy. I don't know if that answered your question, but
no, it kind of did. But I mean, my main concern kind of is that I know we reduced assumed rate of return several times already, right? So, but if we're gonna trend 6%, even in a good, like a lot of good years, I'm just afraid that we'll have to reduce it again, and that's really expensive to the employer. So, it would be a lot of bad things happening after that. So.
That could be an understatement. Yeah. True. Thank you. Any other comments? All right, carry on.
Okay, I just have a couple more slides I'm going to hit on. A good segue from what Tim was talking about the Magnificent Seven. So Artisan is a manager within our global equity book. They're very concentrated. They hold about 45 names. They've underperformed over the year-to-date and one-year period. So year-to-date, 12.5 versus 16.3 for the benchmark, and 20.4 over the 1 year versus 24.7. They're taking a position against this concentration in the markets of saying that this Magnificent Seven party that's run for this long, they don't believe it's going to continue going forward as much. And so their positioning is away from that Magnificent Seven. But it did not work out really over the last year. Tim told you the numbers of, about how much some of these names have been up. But that's one of the managers that's taking a position against that in the portfolio. The other area I want to hit on this page, and this was teed up a little bit, is private real estate. So this has been one of the biggest underperformers in the portfolio. There's a couple of things going on here. We've seen write-downs. So we believe we've gotten through the largest part of that write-down cycle on some of these legacy. When I say legacy, it's these pre-COVID managers that we've hired. So we think we're done with most of that. We are going to be coming back next month with our annual real estate review, where we'll really dive in depth, dive into what's going on in this book much more in depth. The other aspects of what's happening in private real estate today is we're committing a lot of capital to this space. So we've got a lot of new funds that are in that early J-curve effect. So it's just committing capital, and the NAVs of these funds go down a little bit as you're doing that, but you expect it to come back up over time. So there's been over $100 million committed to this asset class in the last 12 months. So there's a lot of capital being committed here. And you know, we believe that we're towards the end of this write-down cycle with some of our legacy managers. But that's been a pretty painful area for the portfolio.
And office is tanked. Yes. Is that what the main factor there is?
Yeah, I believe that's the main contributor. I'll be able to comment more on it when we really dive in next month of exactly what's happening there. But it's been, I looked across some of the managers, and the big write-downs have happened on some of those pre-COVID managers that were selected in the portfolio.
So when you come back on that, and I realize you parachuted in today and you're fielding these questions, I think it would be useful to sort of set the framework for what the fund's investment on the real estate side has been and maybe hasn't been. Because at least from my perspective, in a very high level, I have the understanding that our real estate investment is not, you know, all in core gateway markets, downtown office space, right? So it's decidedly not that.
Yes.
And I think it would be useful to put perspective on that, and I'm sure Tim will do this as well, to put some perspective on what the real estate portfolio looks like, because the headlines are all about what's happening, you know, 20 miles from here, and you know, some significant write downs and other core markets. But at least my understanding is, you know, real estate that we're invested in includes multifamily, you know, significant investments in I won't call them secondary markets, but outside of urban core markets, research and development, real estate investments. I can think of a couple. One I think I toured on a due diligence visit. So I'll stop talking, but I just want perspective on that, because we all read the headlines. Everybody's keyed into what's happening in core office. But I think it would be useful to have a real full understanding of what the real estate portfolio looks like, where the hits have been, and why.
Yep. We'll definitely come back next month with a much more in-depth look at that.
Okay. Fair enough.
I think just on the real estate, it's important to remember you get two things going on. One is COVID changing the office space and how we use properties. The other is higher rates are just going to impact all the values. So you have a depression of all values across the board because of the higher rates. And that should revert as rates come back down. We haven't seen a whole lot of transactions for obvious reasons. But then you have the very specific issue of how do we use office space and how do we use multifamily, and has that changed? And that's, to me, that's the bigger conversation is, are we targeting the right property types and the right property locations on a go-forward basis? The valuations are going to be what the valuations are based on where the rates move. I think it's, to your point, Chair Gordon, it's important to, you know, pull that apart and really look at this from a couple through a couple different lenses.
Yep, thank you, and I will look forward to that report. I think it's going to be illuminating.
Yield plan. I think it should be renamed Total Low Yield because it's one of the lowest yields actually on the list. Even for 10 years, it's 3.3, so why is it high yield?
Exactly. It's an aspirational title.
Yeah, good question. So over the one-year period, it doesn't look so bad, but yes, three-month or year-to-date, maybe not as strong. Moving on just to the next page, and this will be the last page I'll comment on. I had put a pin in this diversifying asset class, and I want to address that. If you look over the one-year period at the diversifying asset class, it's up 1.1, really underperforming that custom diversifying benchmark at 5.4. So this is where we had a manager change over the quarter. So Acadian was liquidated during the second quarter. They had really been underperforming their benchmark, and this is the big contributor to underperformance in this asset class over the 1 and 3 year time frame. They had a departure of their CEO in 2023. We had placed a provisional flag on them, and we were watching them, and I think came to the consensus that it didn't fit in the portfolio anymore at that point. The new manager is BHDG Systematic. That was incepted during the quarter, during April, so we're not showing a full quarter of performance here, but that'll obviously flow through once we get more a full quarter of performance for them. So that'll conclude my remarks. Any questions I can answer on the remaining performance there?
Any further questions for Danny on the...
Sorry, just a quick question on the diversifying. What's the custom diversifying benchmark?
That is going to be in the appendix. Let me scroll down and find this real quick. Custom diversifying benchmark. Maybe we can add some pages to this report so we can find the appendix even slower. Okay, custom diversifying benchmark. It is 35.7% Bloomberg U.S. Ag, 21.4% FTSE T-bills plus 4%, 21.4% FTSE T-bills plus 5%, and 21.4% Bloomberg U.S. Ag plus 1%.
That's gone away with the liquidation of Acadian. We have a different way of measuring that. It's probably something associated with Acadian, I think.
Okay, but it's designed to be a roll-up of the...
It's a roll-up of something, but some of those components were artifact components, so we need to take a look at that.
Okay. Yeah, I hate to have some structure that we kind of artificially headwinded against. And then just touching on the new strategy there, August, the beginning of August was kind of a rough month in terms of volatility. It looks like the strategy is outperforming at least the trend index. I was wondering if somebody had any comments on that.
Welcome, Mitch. Did we get any updated numbers? We looked at this in early August, but do we have any updated numbers on BHDG? As has the index in general, trend in general.
Yeah, and I still think trend is a great fit for the diversifying allocation. I think just in terms of expectations, though, like the rest of the pieces in there are kind of core bond-ish, fixed income-ish, steady return profile, and with the addition of trend for like a quarter of the allocation, I think you're going to get periods, right, where you have deviations from policy, especially I'm not sure what the policy index is going to be when it's kind of adjusted for that.
Yeah, and obviously the board disapproved changes to the risk diversifying program, and those are going to get implemented over the next year, so we'll take a look at what the policy index should be as we kind of come through that process as well.
Any other thoughts or questions? Not seeing any. So, Danny, were you concluded at that point? Are we done? All right. All right. Well, thank you. And thank you for subbing in. You did a fine job and appreciate the circumstance. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. And with that lead-in, let's move on to item 7, which is a review of the report on the risk diversifying sub-portfolio. I'm sorry. Yes, I was getting ahead of myself. Mr. Price, staff report on the quarterly performance.
Yep, I'll just wait one moment for it to come up here, and I'll be brief. We've discussed the second quarter at length, but I want to just give a few highlights here, and then we'll step through it. So obviously this is, nope, that is the wrong one.
Yeah, it's the one that I said, unfortunately, yeah. This would be 6B.
6B.
So, Candace, to avoid confusion, because I realize I jumped around there, we're actually on 6B, which is the staff presentation following the Verus report on the quarterly performance.
Don't worry. I'm following you. Thank you so much.
All right, well, that's coming up. We can go ahead and start addressing this. The board, this is a look back at the second quarter. I'm going to move through this fairly quickly because I think it's more important of the changes that we're making over the upcoming year. A lot of the themes that we saw in the second quarter are carry forwards from the past year here. There are a couple of measures we want to take a look at changing on a going forward basis, in terms of highlighting a little bit different information in this report versus the Verus report. I think there's a little bit of overlap here, and obviously some question marks about the time frames we're looking at here in the CIO report versus time frames we're looking at in the Verus report. So I think, you know, going forward, we want to take a look at automating some of this. We have a new platform, the CAISA platform, that we're implementing. We're getting the kinks ironed out of that. So expect to see some new reports here as we come towards the end of the year. Page 3 of the report, if you got it in front of you, gives the scorecard there, and this is the is it working, is it not, on asset allocation on a big picture basis, and everything is measured versus what it, could have we implemented this in just a public markets mandate and a simple target index. So this takes a look at, we've done a diversified program. Has that worked? Short answer there is, given the concentration in the U.S. stock market, all that diversification that's built into the growth portfolio really hasn't borne out in the portfolio. And we see that in the middle of the chart there. You see the growth segment some of the underperformance on a relative basis versus that ACWI benchmark. So real estate underperforming the stock market. Private equity over this time period, holding back a bit over the three-year period, the five-year period still looks good because we had a plus 60% year in there and a bunch of flat years. And then the diversifying program, we talked about the challenges with Acadian that exited the portfolio in May. EHDG was implemented in April, and we're going to take a look at some additional enhancements, and Mitch will touch on that when we do the risk diversifying review right after this. So I'm going to turn to page 4. And just give the scorecard on the liquidity portfolio. So short duration fixed income, these managers, the yields are up. So that's great news. We've got that enhanced yield component there. Everything is kind of clicking along in an as expected manner. I think one of the things to highlight here is you have a little bit of differentiation in the, I can't see that from here, and I'm trying to get it on my screen. You have a little bit of differentiation in the duration between some of the managers. And if you take a look at Insight, it's got a duration of about a year, kind of what we expect. SIT is positioned at the farther end of that at a 2.9 year. It's still within short duration, but they've kind of positioned themselves out a bit further. And SIT takes a quantitative approach to the market. They say if there's an inverted yield curve, we're just going to sit at the front end of the yield curve and take that coupon, and it will change when the market changes. So you have a couple of managers who are taking market views that rates are going to come down and they want to be beneficiaries of that. And then you've got a manager who says, I want to be at the front end and just harvest that yield. If you kind of carry that forward to the total returns, everybody's in a good place for short duration fixed income. Certainly DFA recently with that super short duration and an inverted yield curve has done really, really well for this space. So I think that's the takeaway there. If we move forward to the growth portfolio, you see mostly green on this page in terms of portfolio assessment, asset growth. The ones I'm going to highlight would be the TT. We've talked about this. You had a personnel change. They lost some sub-advised clients in that process. So you have a reduction in the asset base of that fund. We were on site with them early this year. And it got comfortable with the new approach. I think it's more of the reset approach rather than a new approach there. Recent performances come back up. AQR and Panagora would be the other ones I would highlight in terms of having asset reductions there. This is risk parity. The board just decided to terminate risk parity, so these two managers will be exiting the portfolio over the next couple of months here. Take a look at performance. Now, this is where we do see some red on the screen, and Jerry had brought this up previously, but we can address it here. TT, two really rough years, personnel change. We think they're on the right path, but they've got to dig out of that hole. We go down to the bottom, you see not meeting expectations for FOIA. Dennis, you brought it up. This high yield should be called low yield. This has not worked. The board also voted to eliminate this last month, so this is going away. And we think the multi-asset credit approach is going to have a lot more levers to pull. It should be in a better position there. AQR and Panagora, risk parity simply hasn't worked. And there was, it looks really elegant on paper, but when rates go up, it hurts. And when stocks and bonds are positively correlated with each other, it gets hurt. And there's just always something that's holding it back. And I think patience ran out and we eliminated this. So you'll see that drop off this page on a going forward basis. Real estate, as Danny mentioned, we'll review that in a deep dive next month and take a look at what's going on there. I did want to highlight private equity just in terms of we've seen a very flat performance for a couple of years here. We've been deploying capital. We're getting a little bit back from legacy funds, but the balance hasn't moved around a whole lot, so you're seeing these kind of flat returns. Anecdotally, we are hearing more transactions and more exits since the end of the second quarter, so here in these summer months. It seems that we're seeing a pickup in activity. That's going to take a couple quarters to flow through because if there's an IPO, we're in a lockup period until we can get the capital, but we should see some of that start to come through on the call it the 2018 to 2020 vintage funds where they're seeing a little bit more flow in there. And then the diversifying program, Acadian exited, BHD coming in, and we're going to do a little bit deeper dive there, so I'm not going to spend time on this right now. This chart, is diversification working? Well, no, it's not. The downside protection has been there. The upside capture has not. The upside capture is largely the growth portfolio. The things we've done to diversify that versus just a global equity benchmark, it's been tough. And that is largely the story of this Magnificent Seven. Our managers are underexposed to the Magnificent Seven. Our structure biases us towards small cap, international and emerging markets. Those biases were largely neutralized in this most recent asset allocation study. So we're more in line with the marketplace on a going forward basis. But over this 3-year period, we had had higher allocations to those spaces on a structural basis. So that's been the challenge there. And then I'll just wrap it up on this one. Clearly, we've seen some more challenges over more recent periods. If you take a look at that the table in the middle, underperforming the simple target index, underperforming the simple implementation over more recent periods. We still see outperformance over the 5-year, outperformance on a Sharpe ratio basis over the 5-year period, but we have had those challenges on an interim basis that needed to be addressed. We're hopeful that the asset allocation and the implementation over the upcoming year is the tool we need to address that. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions for Tim on the report.
This is a question on page 5. What is the product asset versus firm asset? I mean, firm asset is a total asset, but what is the product asset? Right.
The product that we're in, so that, okay. That specific strategy that we're in versus the entire firm. And the reason we take a look at both is obviously the strategy we're in is what we're most concerned about. Mm-hmm. But if that strategy is doing really great, but the firm is struggling, we want to know about that. And so we track that. You know, is there a problem elsewhere in the firm that could bleed over into management mm-hmm. changes on our strategy? So we take a look at both of those.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? And Candace, I don't mean to be overlooking you. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to keep putting you on the spot. But if you do have questions, just please speak up.
I certainly will. And I don't have any questions at this time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Candace. All right. I think that concludes the item then. Thank you, Tim.